I didn't get done talking about the interaction between the sender and the receiver. I want to make a few more remarks about it and then go on to the announced subject today, the IFD pattern of personal maladjustment, in order to relate what we are talking about to problems which are vital to all of us, so that what we are talking about will perhaps be more meaningful than it would be otherwise. I want to finish going through this process. And we have got to the point of the symbolic output . There are many modes, of course, the writing, speaking, and all sorts of sign language, and ordinary gesture, and bodily postures, and facial expressions, and intonations of voice, to say nothing of Morse code, flag waving, the dance, painting, expression through architectural design, through interior decoration, through clothes, through hairdos, and the like. Now, let's talk, though, primarily about this spoken word, because the principles are pretty much the same regardless of the mode of expression. I want just to call attention to something very fundamental, and that is this. When I talk to you, when two people talk to each other, when I talk to you, the only thing that passes between us are vibrations of the air. I think one of the very most powerful illusions that we have is that there is more than that which passes between us. You probably are taking for granted that I am telling you something, that there are ideas in the air here between us. No. You could put any apparatus you want between us here. I'm going to get rid of the noise if I can. Allow us a little ventilation. You could put up any apparatus here between us and you would detect no ideas. Just air vibrations, that's all. No words, nothing but air vibrations. You see, what is going on here is that I encode, I form some air vibration patterns, I send them. You receive them, you decode them, and then encode your decoding. That is, you bring the words. You brought them with you in the door when you came. You are using your own language to tell yourself what I am saying. You are making notes. If I were to gather up the notebooks, they would all be different. You're supplying the words, you see. Your notebooks contain your words, not mine. We often say, or we hear people say, the words are plain, they mean exactly what they say. This is a tremendous delusion. You see, air vibrations do not say anything. Or ink marks on a page do not say anything. Only human beings say. The ink marks are neutral. the air vibrations are utterly neutral. If I were producing these air vibrations by means of the Russian code or the Spanish, most of you would find that the air vibrations have no meaning. Well, they don't have any meaning now either. You came with the meanings. You brought them with you. I brought them with me too. But your meanings are not the same as mine. And they're not the same as your, as the person who is beside you. Now, this means that only you then can take responsibility not only for what you say or send in any way. Only you can take responsibility for what you hear, for what you say you have heard. You tell yourself what you have heard. I don't tell you. There's nothing here that I do except to send air vibrations. And you take it from there. Let's look at it a little more closely. I think that most of the very significant kinds of learning and most of the very significant discoveries, as we call them, or inventions, come from examining what is rather obvious, examining it more simply, more closely than we have in the past. So let's examine now quite closely what is going on here. And let's don't get too involved. Let's take it from here, from my lips. There's a great deal of mystery back of my lips, but let's leave it there. At the point of my lips, the result of the muscular contractions, behind which is a lot of mystery, is that the air comes to be disturbed. In a sense, all I'm doing here is blowing on you. Now, I'm blowing in a coded way, a patterned way, but I'm blowing. If you were real close to me, if I tried to talk against your ear, you would really feel the blowing. Well, I'm still blowing, even though you're too far away to feel it. Now, the air vibrations which I produce travel to your ear, and there's a sort of a canal here which goes down to a tiny piece of modified skin, which we call, as you know, the eardrum. Piece of modified skin. I'm really massaging you. This communication is actually tactile communication, you see. I'm stroking your skin. In a patterned way, with patterned strokes. I produce these strokes by blowing. That's what's going on here. I'm not telling you anything. I'm blowing on you. I'm stroking your skin with breath. Now, there's a pattern to the vibration, to the stroke, and That moves the eardrum, this piece of modified skin. Now there's an energy transformation at that point. The movement of the skin is now transformed into a rather complex movement of a little chain of tiny bones. And there is great attenuation. There's much lost here. From an engineering point of view, this whole thing is very dubious. If this had had to be approved originally by a committee of engineers, I doubt if we would have the kind of ear we've got. There is great attenuation or loss. The movement of the bones preserves, however, the pattern, more or less, although there is a great loss of energy. The movement of the bones activates a movement of another tiny piece of modified skin, which divides the middle ear from the inner ear. It's called by the name of the oval window. Behind the oval window, there are passageways that are filled, more or less, with fluid. And now there's another energy transformation. The movement of the modified of the bones, that movement gets transformed into movement of the skin, of the oval window, tissue there. And that movement now gets transformed into the sloshing of the liquid inside the passageways of the inner ear. And the sloshing of the liquid gets transformed into movement of little tiny hair cells, little hairs. And the wiggling of those gets transformed into something mysterious, which we call the nervous impulse. And now moves on up into the brain, the cortex, and at some point there, you're taking it now from here to here, and there's something going on inside your brain when this nervous impulse, which results in this very indirect way from my nervous impulses, arrives. So I can't be too optimistic about what's going to result here. The chances are not very much is going to happen because I'm making these air vibrations. Because there's so much going on inside your head already that the arrival of this new nervous impulse isn't going to make too much difference, probably. So if you act tomorrow as though you had never heard this lecture, I shouldn't be too surprised. But people are surprised. They act as though they thought you should remember. And this is one of the things that is woefully the matter with American education, I think. We think that if you have had algebra, now you can do the next course. You don't remember much of it, you know. You lose most of this. If you are listening now, you may not be getting any of it. It may be that when this nervous impulse arrives, something terribly interesting is already going on there. And I can't compete at all. But there's a resulting state of affairs. It may be muddled. It's apt to be something quite different from what I intended. And now this is what you transform into your own symbolic forms. This is your symbolization process operating now with your symbols, not mine. You brought your own. You always supply the word. The listener always supplies the words. The speaker supplies nothing but air vibrations. You are responsible for what you heard, for what you hear, for what you say later that you have heard. And you can't pass that buck. The listener is responsible for what he says he heard. And then you will go back to your dormitory, house where you live, and you will give out with some words of your own when someone asks you, if they do, what did the man say? And so you will say what the man said. You will all say something different, of course. And then by the time that has been passed on to two or three other people, what I said today could be almost anything. It's very hazardous to talk in public. Now, I think you need to get a feel for this process at the level of the physical happenings, the physics of the communication is what you need to understand. What is going on here physically that you could detect with instruments? You could detect air vibrations of certain frequencies and amplitudes and patterns between us, and that is all. Now, there's a feedback. You don't only talk to the person to whom you think you are talking. You now, as you talk, you are now affecting yourself. You are the listener in this diagram. You represent this part of the diagram while I am talking, and I represent this part. I am the sender. You are the receiver. But now when you talk, when you tell someone else what I said, you are telling that to another person and to yourself as your own listener. There is feedback all the way along the line. Every part of this is interacting with every other part, so that your symbolic processes are affecting the state of your nervous system, which is affecting your very perceptions, your sensory input, and so on all the way along the process. And finally, there is a great loop which is designed to represent the fact that every speaker is his most affected listener, enchanted listener, whatever, captive listener. I'm getting more out of this lecture today than you are because I'm paying more attention to it. I'm probably being affected more by it. Perhaps not always in desirable ways. Now we're going to come back to this matter. We'll be talking a good deal about it when we have more to say about it. I want now to shift gears and talk about a kind of pattern, a personal problem, in terms of which perhaps what we have been talking about up to now and what we are going to say from here on might take on more meaning than it would otherwise. We all have personal problems. If you think of a normal person as a person who has no problems, well, then there are no normal people. And of course that can't be what we can mean significantly by normal people. What are the problems that we have for the most part? Well, you find out by placing yourself in a position behind a desk in a room with the right words on the door. This is a kind of a door that attracts people who say they have problems, and they come to talk to you about them. Now, there are thousands of people who sit behind desks like this around the country. They're called psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, counselors of various sorts, marriage counselors, child guidance people. They're social workers. They're speech pathologists, and so forth. And from the accumulated experience, as I interpret it, and I can only talk to you as I interpret it, these, what you're hearing now, if you call them sounds, they are the sounds that Wendell's nervous system makes. And you must evaluate them accordingly. This is not the thunder speaking. This is just Wendell. Now, as I interpret this accumulated experience, as it has been reported, and as I have participated in it personally, there does appear to be the possibility of making a generalization to the effect that most of the problems that people have, and we won't bother now to define this very much, can be reduced to a pattern. These problems involve disappointment. You ask the person who comes to see you with a problem, what is the matter, and he's likely to say in one way or another that things are not going as well as they should for him. He's disappointed somehow. There's a discrepancy between what he thinks life should be like and what he finds it to be like. Now, he may go into detail. Each one will go into detail in his own way. But the pattern is pretty much the same. And it comes out after you've heard enough of the story in each case to be reducible to the formula IFD. Can we have, there's a slide. Oh, you got it. From idealism to frustration to demoralization. Idealism is a word that bothers some people here in this kind of a context, I suppose, because we're supposed to have idealism. And I think so too. But there are ideals and then there are ideals. And the kinds that you find in the, when you talk to the maladjusted, may we have the next slide, tend to have certain peculiar characteristics. They are rather vague. We can say that they're high in a functional sense. They're high ideals. Functionally, that is, they operate as high ideals. In the sense that, for example, they're vague. A person tells you that wants very much to be successful, or he wants to be good, or he wants to be normal. That's an interesting one. He wants to be fluent. He wants to be a normal speaker. I hear this over and over. This is vague, so that the person who says this is his goal or objective or ideal has no way of knowing when he has achieved it. And so it has the effect, this experience has the effect of making him feel that he never has achieved his ideal. So that he constantly experiences a kind of frustration. He wants to be popular. Well, how many friends do you have to have before you are popular? What else has to be true about these friends? How many friends can you manage at one time, by the way? They're time-consuming, you know. They get sick and you have to take time off to go to the hospital to see them. And you have to take time to find a card to send them. You have to find time to buy a present for them. You have to find time to go to coffee with them. How many can you manage at once? Not very many. Your friends will get you down if you're not careful. And so this desire to be popular can be most exhausting. It can really wear you out, because you never can be sure you're popular enough. And so you try to get one more friend, and that takes up another hour a day. And then finally you're just worn down by it. You feel terribly frustrated and exhausted and tired all the time. You've been up too late, too many nights in a row, you know, with your friends. So it pays to be very clear about what you're talking about. This isn't just an academic matter. This isn't just academic linguistics. This has a great deal to do with how happy you are, or even how tired you get. Vagueness can really wear you out. It keeps you running too long, too hard. You never know when you're through. Or the ideals are high as they are defined. You ask a person like this, now, come on, tell me, what do you really want? Be definite about it. Well, he may make an attempt to define what he means by popularity, or by success, or by normal speech, or whatever it is. It's obvious if you have a goal, for instance, wealth. Well, how much money do you want? Try to name it for yourself. Take 10 seconds right now. 10 years from now, how much money do you want to have? Now, if you were to write all those numbers down and average them, I think you would be amazed. I have done this a few times, and they always come out to be so high. The average is so high that it means that the average person is going to be frustrated. He just isn't going to get that much money. The stutterer, when asked, how fluently do you want to talk? Well, it turns out he just wants to talk perfectly fluently. Well, nobody does. So, of course, he's going to be frustrated. He never will get over it. If that's his goal. There is no kind of treatment that can get him over it. His ideal is too high. So you don't solve his problem by teaching him how to talk more and more smoothly. That would just aggravate the problem. You solve the problem by enabling him to get a realistic perspective on what is possible for him. And this is the way you solve most problems. You don't solve the problem of an adolescent girl who worries about the way she looks by trying to make her more and more and more beautiful. It's hopeless. You're just going to drive her to taking too many sleeping pills sometime. The only way she's going to gain tranquility is by getting a realistic notion of how she might look and learning to live with that. If she comes to see you because she's worried about this, she practically never talks about how she looks. She talks about how she wants to look. And when she talks about how she looks, her statements are apt to be very prejudiced. They're vague. And so far as they can be in any way tested against reality, they tend to be inaccurate. Moreover, these ideals tend to be high. They function as high ideals in that they are overvalued. So the girl who wants to be good-looking, well, if she isn't good-looking, life is just not worth living. If this is what she values. The stutterer who wants to talk perfectly fluently and can't, well, he's unhappy because it's so important to him. So many of these problems turn out to be to involve a good deal of preoccupation or overvaluation of the non-essential. It really is not as too important how you look. It really is not too important how smoothly you talk. What is highly important is, after all, what it is that you have to say. You can talk very disfluently and talk a lot of sense and be worth listening to. And you can talk very smoothly and demoralize everybody who hears you, or confuse them, or divide them one against another, or send them to their death, as Hitler did. No one ever talked more smoothly than Hitler. And he had, I would say, about as serious a defect of speech as you could have. He killed people when he talked. Can you think of anything more serious than that? What's important here? What you say or how it sounds? What's important? How you look or the kind of person you are to live with? Most problems that people bring to clinics are of this kind. They involve overvaluations of the superficial. But basically, they involve these high ideals that can't be recognized, so they can't be achieved, or they're too highly placed if they are defined to be achieved. They're overvalued, so when they're not achieved, the result is demoralization. Let's have the next slide, Doug.
Can you read it? The frustration, we tend to react to frustration in certain pretty predictable ways. We react with irritation, with resentment, aggressiveness, hostility, ill will, just a general nasty disposition. And it's a very understandable kind of reaction. I think we all have a sort of first order appreciation of this kind of behavior because we've all experienced it. But if this goes on too long and is a reaction to frustration that is very important to us, and if the reactions, the resentment, the hostility, aggressiveness, and whatnot, does not pay off, if the frustration continues, well, most of us eventually wear out. Almost everybody has a breaking point. You give up. You are demoralized. You've had it. And somewhere or other you tend to leave the field. But not always graciously. Hardly ever graciously do you leave the field. You leave with feelings of disappointment and failure and anxiety and a sort of a basic fear about living. And You do other things. You tend to cling to anything you feel secure with. It's so hard for you to feel secure. And so if you feel secure with some kind of, something as silly as a color preference, you'll hang on to that. You always like blue. Because if you don't have something on you that is blue, well, you don't feel secure. You only feel secure when you're wearing blue. Well, this sort of behavior is found in people who tend to be quite demoralized. They're no longer very sure of themselves. They've been beaten down, and they don't have much to feel secure about anymore. And so they tend to be rigid in their behavior. It's hard for them to change now because this involves a risk. And this is part of the behavior that people show who come to clinics. They want help, but they would like to receive it. Participating in it is another matter. They'd rather take a pill than to launch themselves on a campaign of modifying their own behavior. Because this would involve a risk. Well, I'm going to call on the panel. You haven't interrupted me yet. You have anything to say by way of reaction? Am I talking to you or past you or? Many angles to this. The rigidity of people who have problems of the kind we're talking about is rather obvious. The language rigidity is, to me, highly interesting. If they have things they say when they talk about important matters, we call them attitudes. They tend to cling to them. You have read, no doubt, in many books on abnormal psychology, personality, maladjustment psychology, that you can't argue very effectively with a person who has a delusion or who has a maladjustment. You can't argue. You can't talk people out of their maladjustments. This is pretty largely true. If by this you mean you're going to tell a person now what he ought to think, or how he ought to feel, or what he ought to do. No, that's not much good, because they like to cling to, or whether they like to or not, they do tend to cling to what they're used to verbally. And partly, I think, because not always, but for part of the things they say over and over, they share these verbal rituals with other people who are important to them, their friends, their family. And so if they were to change too much, they'd have to get a new friend or a new family even. They could never go home again. And so this is part of what you're dealing with when you try to help people. And part of the reason why so often you have to work with the whole family or with a person and his main associates, or you can't get very far, because the person alone can't alienate himself by improving too much. Can't alienate himself from the people with whom he is associated in important relationships. For instance, Barbara Bain, am I talking past you, or do you find this disagreeable, or do you have any questions?
The thing that I would find somewhat disagreeable was when you said that words are in the listener only, it's the meaning of words. because by our society, we're going to arrange words that are come down with different meanings. And it might be a shade different, but generally speaking, a tree to tree equivalent. You may think of an open eye of maple, but it still has these same characteristics.
That's a good point. The fact remains, you are the one who supplies your words. Now, your words may coincide with mine, to begin with, just the verbal forms. We may listen to the same person talking, and afterwards we may give identical reports, we'll say, verbally. The words will be the same. But in each case, that is, I supplied the words and you supplied the words. They happen to coincide. We do belong to the same culture. Very often we will say about the same thing. In terms of the word, the ink marks or the air vibration, what those words mean to you and to me, though, are not likely to be the same.
Now,
similar. And a difference, to be a difference, has to make a difference. And some differences simply don't happen to make a difference. But there are always differences. And if you're oriented to ignore differences, this is kind of hazardous. They may not be important in a given instance, but to act as though they weren't there at all, to say to somebody else, I know exactly how you feel, this is almost always presumptuous. And can be a strain to both persons involved. Let's have the next slide. I don't know whether I can handle this in 4 minutes or not. Our language has a kind of structure. Now, it can be talked about by the grammarian. You've learned grammar. At least somebody attempted to help you learn it, and you learned it more or less, probably. But there is also another kind of structure, level of structure to our language. The language forms, the language forms, the sentence forms that we use, the arrangements of words, imply some basic assumptions, premises, postulates, whatever you want to call them. And these were summarized and very well stated by Aristotle and have come to be called Aristotelian rules or laws or postulates of the language. Whatever you may be talking about, you tend to observe these rules. You tend to talk as though the same word means the same thing all the time. A is A. Normal is normal. Now, you only have to use that one example to glimpse the hazard involved. People are people. But we know that they differ. And yet the language says they are the same. A is A. This is the basic rule that we're operating in terms of. As the rule for a game called language, or the rule for a game called, a little more accurately, logic. This is a good rule, and you can play the game exceedingly well with it. The danger comes in mistaking what is a rule for a game for a communicative instrument. There is a built-in error in the rule if you use it to communicate with, because person one is never the same as person two. A is never A on the level of actuality. It's only on the level of a game, of logic, that A is A. As I say in the book, I think, the tenth banana is never like the first one. If you've eaten nine bananas, or something like that. Artie Shaw would say that the eighth wife is not at all like the first one. So wife does not equal wife. A is not A. And there is the law that the Aristotelian rule of the game of logic, that X or anything cannot or has to be either A or not A. And by the law of non-contradiction, it can't be both. This means that what is normal for one person, an experience, a characteristic, has to be either normal or not normal. Well, this is, of course, no good to live by. It's perfectly good to play the game of logic by, but it's no good to live by, or to talk about yourself or other people by. Because the same experience can be normal for one individual and not for another, or for the same individual. In different situations, the same experience, so far as it can be the same, can be both normal and abnormal. These observations are rather obvious once they're pointed out, but they tend not to be pointed out or emphasized. So we tend to talk as though these Aristotelian laws of logic were laws of nature. And this has very dire consequences. And this underlies much of what we have been talking about.